mad if he wakes up and we're not there?
What is he, our babysitter?
Eight cracks merrily, reaching out to shake me gently by the shoulders. Loosen up. Let's be tourists for a couple of hours. Gazing down from the windows of Nine's penthouse never gave me a real sense of how truly busy the streets of downtown Chicago are. We exit into the midday sun and are immediately hit with a wall of noise, people talking, car horns blaring. It reminds me of the marketplace back in Spain, except times 1,000. Eight and I both find ourselves craning our necks upward, trying to take in the buildings that tower above us. We're walking slow, people shooting us annoyed looks as they're forced to cut around us. It's a little intense for me out here. All these people, the noise. It's way more than I'm used to. I find myself slipping my hand into the crook of Eight's elbow, just to make sure we aren't accidentally separated and lost in the crowd. He smiles at me.
Where to? He asks.
That way, I point, picking a direction at random. We end up on the waterfront. It's much more peaceful here. The humans wandering around the shore of Lake Michigan are like us. Not in a rush to get anywhere. Some of them sit down on benches eating their lunches, while others jog and bike by us, exercising. I feel suddenly sad for these people. So much hangs in the balance, and they have no idea. Eight touches my arm gently.
You're frowning.
Sorry, I reply, forcing a smile. Just thinking.
Less of that, he says with mock sternness. We're just going out for a walk, no big deal.
I try to put the doom and gloom out of my mind and act the part of a tourist, like Eight said. The lake is crystalline and beautiful, a few boats lazily cutting across its surface. We amble by sculptures and outdoor cafes, Eight taking an interest in everything, trying to consume as much of the local culture as possible, and cheerily trying to get me interested. We stand before a large silver sculpture that looks like a cross between a satellite dish and a half-peeled potato. I believe this human work was secretly influenced by the great Lorik artist Hugo von Lohr, Eight says, stroking his chin thoughtfully.
You're making that up.
Eight shrugs. I'm just trying to be a better tour guide. His easygoing enthusiasm is infectious, and soon I'm wrapped up in this game of making up silly stories for the various landmarks we pass. When I finally realize that we've spent more than an hour on the waterfront, I feel guilty. Maybe we should get back, I tell Eight, feeling like we're shirking our responsibilities, even though I know there's nothing for us to do but wait. Hold on, he says, pointing. Look at that. From the hushed way Eight speaks, I expect to see a Mogadorian scout on our trail. Instead, following his gaze, I see a chubby older man behind a food cart selling what's advertised as Chicago-style hot dog. He hands one off to a customer. The hot dog is covered in pickle and tomato slices and chopped up onions barely contained in the bun.
That's the most monstrous thing I've ever seen, Eight says.
I chuckle, and when my stomach suddenly growls, that chuckle turns into a full-on guffaw. I think it sort of looks good, I manage.
Have I mentioned that I'm a vegetarian? Eight asks, staring at me with mock revulsion.
But if it's the frightening mess of a Chicago-style hot dog you desire, then so it shall be. I've never thanked you properly. Eight starts towards the vendor, but I grab him by the arm and drag him back. He grins at me.
Change your mind?
What do you mean you never thanked me properly? I ask. Thanked me for what?
For saving my life in New Mexico.
You broke the prophecy, Marina.
Cetricus Ra put his sword right through me, and you brought me back to life. I can't help blushing and looking down at my feet. It was nothing. It was literally everything to me. I look up, putting on my best version of 8's teasing smile. In that case, I think I deserve more than a gross hot dog. 8 clasps his hands across his chest like I've wounded him. You're right. I'm a fool to think my life could be traded for a hot dog. He grabs my hand and gets down on one knee, pressing his forehead to the back of my hand. My savior, what can I ever do to repay you? I'm embarrassed, but I can't help laughing. I shoot apologetic looks to the people around us, most of them staring at 8's display with curious smiles. We must look like just two normal teenagers to them, goofing around and flirting. I pull 8 back to his feet and, still holding his hand, continue on down the lakefront. The sun winks across the surface of the lake. It's not quite the sea I was named for, but it's beautiful all the same. You can promise me more days like these, I tell 8. He squeezes my hand tightly. Consider it done. 8 and I finally come back to the penthouse, our bellies full of greasy Chicago pizza. We've still got hours before 4 and 6 arrive in Arkansas, and Ella never sent up any telepathic alarm. Everything is just as we left it. Except 9 is awake and standing so close to the elevator door that we almost crash into him when we enter. 9 doesn't move when we come in. He just stands there with his arms crossed over his chest and glares at us. Where have you two been? Geez, says 8, inching around 9's bulk. How long have you been standing here waiting for us? Aren't your feet tired? We just went out for a bit, I explain, feeling more than a little timid around 9. It reminds me of getting caught sneaking back into the orphanage after curfew, and I briefly picture 9 trying to take a ruler to my knuckles. Is everything all right? Everything's fine, snaps 9, focusing more on 8 than me. You can't just go gallivanting around the city without telling me. Why not? Counters 8. Because it's bullshit, growls 9. I can see his mind working, like he's trying to think of something else to say. It's irresponsible and careless. It's stupid. It was a couple of hours, complains 8, rolling his eyes. Spare me this sapon lecture. It's kind of funny to see 9 so enraged about us acting out of line, especially considering the stories I've heard 4 tell about their time together on the road. Strangely, it's also endearing. He puts on this big show of being this tough-as-nails loose cannon, but when he woke up to find us gone, he was actually concerned about us. I touch 9 on the arm, trying to defuse the situation. I'm sorry we worried you. Whatever, I wasn't worried, 9 snarls, jerking his arm away from me and rounding on 8 again. You think that was a lecture? Maybe I should show you the kind of lectures I used to get back when I was a cocky little dumbass. 8 wiggles his finger at 9, just egging him on further. Most of the time, his joking around is charming, but this is one of those times when I'd wish he'd just cut it out. 9 steps right up to 8. They'd be nose to nose if 8 was a few inches taller. 8 doesn't back down, still smiling, like it's all just a goof. Come on, says 9, his voice low. I've seen you in the lecture hall playing patty cake with 6. You ain't trained with me yet. 8 glances down at an imaginary watch. Sure, dude. I've got time to kill. 9 smiles. He looks over his shoulder at me. You too, Nurse Marina. Your boyfriend's gonna need you. Chapter 9. I'm going to whip you into shape, declares Nine. That way, the next time there's a mission, we won't be the ones left sitting on our asses.
Eight and I stand in the lecture hall side by side, watching as Nine circles around us, sizing us up like some kind of army drill instructor. I feel like rolling my eyes, and I can tell Eight is barely suppressing a fit of laughter. Still, I do feel sort of guilty about basically sneaking out with Eight, and I'm sure a little training couldn't hurt. Plus, I think Nine is still bummed about being left out of Four's rescue mission, and he seems really into this whole training thing. I decide to humor him.
Unless you'd rather just be bench warmers. You want to hang out and go eat pizza while the rest of us kill Cetricus Raw?
Nine snarls as he stops in front of us, staring us down.
No, sir, I say, trying to be serious. Eight immediately bursts out laughing.
Nine ignores Eight for now, focusing instead on me. Healing and night vision. That's about it, huh?
I can breathe underwater, I add helpfully.
All right, says Nine, considering my legacies. Maybe you'll develop a good fighting legacy one day. Maybe you won't. We'd still all be dead if it wasn't for you, I guess. I know Johnny's supposed to have the healing thing now, too, but I think he only heals girls he's dating, so the rest of us still need you. Anyway, we'll need to practice your speed and agility so that when one of us goes down, you'll be able to get to us. And maybe your healing will, like, evolve into something else if you practice with it enough.
To my surprise, most of what Nine says actually makes sense. Except one thing nags at me.
How are we going to practice my healing?
Nine's smile is sinister. Something I'd be really afraid to see from across the battlefield.
Oh, you'll see. As for you, he continues, turning to Eight, I thought you were pretty badass when we first met. And then you took a sword to the chest first chance you got. Nice job.
Eight's expression darkens as he's reminded of his running in with Cetricus Raw.
He tricked me.
Uh-huh, says Nine.
Way I remember it, you were so focused with copying a feel, hugging, fake six, that you got stabbed.
You give a lot of hugs in the middle of a battle, bro?
Use your head.
It seems like you could use a hug right now, says Eight, grinning mischievously.
Before Nine knows what's happening, Eight shapeshifts into his four-armed Vishnu form, leaps forward, and wraps Nine up in a tight embrace. I can see the muscles in Nine's neck and shoulders tense as Eight squeezes him.
Let me go, warns Nine through gritted teeth. You're the boss.
Eight teleports, taking Nine with him. He reappears just inches away from the ceiling and releases Nine. Disoriented, Nine doesn't have a chance to gather himself and crashes to the floor on his back. Before Nine even lands, Eight has teleported back to my side.
Ta-da!
He says, reassuming his normal form.
You're just going to make him mad, I whisper.
Eight only shrugs. Nine hops back to his feet and rolls his head from side to side, cracking his neck. He nods, looking almost impressed.
Pretty good move, he says.
Maybe I should be training you, quips Eight.
Try it again.
Shrugging, Eight shapeshifts again. He wraps Nine in the same hug, this time approaching warily as if he's expecting Nine to launch a counterattack.
I'm expecting the same thing, cringing as I wait for Nine to throw an elbow into Eight's face.
Surprisingly, Nine doesn't fight back at all.
Eight teleports them back to the ceiling again, but this time, when he's released from Eight's grasp, Nine quickly reaches his hand up to touch the ceiling. It makes me queasy just to watch.
Nine's gravity shifting so that instead of falling to the floor, he's doing a handstand on the ceiling. It all takes no more than a second. Eight's already teleported away, reappearing back at my side. Just like Nine was expecting. Nine launches himself from the ceiling and, as soon as Eight materializes, Nine is plummeting towards him. Eight only has a moment to notice that Nine is lying on the floor where he expected him to be. The next thing he knows, Nine's foot is connecting with his sternum, sending him flying to the ground. Eight picks himself up onto his elbows, wheezing, the wind knocked out of him. Nine stands over him, his hands on his hips. "Predictable," Nine says. "Why would you teleport back to the same place?" In answer, Eight coughs, rubbing his chest. Nine reaches down and helps him to his feet. "It's all about surprise with you, man," Nine explains. "You gotta keep 'em guessing." Eight lifts up his shirt. There's a foot-shaped bruise already forming over his ribs. "Damn, that was like getting hit with a sledgehammer." "Thanks," says Nine, and looks at me. "Here's some practice for you." I place my hands gently on Eight's chest. The icy feeling of my legacy tingles in my fingertips, passing through me and into Eight. It's only a bruise, so it's easy. I don't even have to concentrate, which is good, because it's not that easy for me to concentrate while touching Eight's chest. If this is what training is going to be like, I could get used to it. "Thanks," says Eight when I step back. On the other side of the room, Nine has grabbed one of the stuffed Mogadorian training dummies and dumped it on the ground. He stands over it, looking at us. "Okay, here's the game. We're going to pretend this dummy is, I don't know, number 4. He gets hurt all the time, right? So, he's wounded and, Marina, you need to get to him and work your magic. Eight, you're going to help her." "And what are you going to be doing?" I ask. "I'm going to be the surprisingly good-looking Mogadorian that's standing in your way." Eight and I exchange a look. 2-on-1, he says. "Sounds easy." "Cool," says Nine, extending his pipe staff and twirling it menacingly over his head. "Let's see what you got." Eight puts his arm around me, pulling me into a quick huddle. "He expects us to go right at him," he whispers. I nod, catching on to the plan quickly. "You should just teleport the body back to me." Eight holds his hand up to me for a quick high five, then spins back to face Nine. "Ready? Bring it on." Eight starts forward, and Nine stalks out to meet him in the center of the room. As soon as he's drawn Nine a few yards away from the dummy, Eight disappears, reappearing over the dummy. It's not that Nine doesn't notice what Eight's up to. He just doesn't care. He bounds a few steps forward, coming straight for me. Caught off guard and more than a little nervous with Nine charging me, I backpedal. Nine is far too quick for me. When Eight reappears with a dummy, Nine is standing with the tip of his staff pressed against the side of my neck. "Good job," he says to Eight. "Now you've got a wounded friend and a dead healer." I've never trained like this before, so Nine coming right at me felt really intimidating. I have to get over that feeling. I know Six wouldn't have just let Nine put that staff up to her throat. I need to prove to these boys that even though I don't have the offensive firepower they do, I can still fight back. With Nine distracted by Eight, I slap the point of his staff away from my neck. "Not dead yet," I say, as I lunge forward and punch him in the mouth. Immediately,
A flare of pain courses through my hand and wrist. 9 staggers back a step as 8 whoops with happy surprise. 9 whips his head back around to look at me, blood lining his teeth as he grins.
Good,
he shouts, delighted. You're getting it.
I think I broke my thumb,
I reply, looking down at my swollen knuckles. Next time, keep your thumb outside your fingers when you punch, 8 says, balling up his fist to demonstrate. I nod, feeling sort of dumb that I'd make such a basic mistake, but also a little thrilled that I just socked 9 right in the face. He seems to have appreciated it too, looking at me with a newfound respect as he wipes the blood off of his face. I touch my hand, again feeling the icy sensation of my legacy, intensified this time as it passes into my own hand. 9 has picked up the dummy and dumped it back on the other side of the room.
Ready to try again?
8 and I huddle up for the second time.
Maybe I should introduce him to our old friend, Narasimha.
Which one is that? Lots of arms, lots of claws. Sounds perfect, I say. Keep him busy, and I'll flank him. We break our huddle, and 8 immediately transforms into one of his massive avatars. His handsome features melt away, replaced by the snarling face and golden mane of a lion. He grows to about 12 feet, 10 arms sprouting out on his sides, each of them tipped with razor-sharp claws. 9 whistles through his teeth.
Now we're talking,
9 says.
One of your parents must have been a chimera. Probably your mom.
Funny,
replies 8,
his voice a gravelly roar while in this shape.
I stay behind 8 as he stalks towards 9, waiting for an opening to make a break for the dummy. 8 lunges forward, slashing at 9 with all his arms, forcing 9 to duck and weave away, parrying some of the blows with his staff. 9 prods at 8 with his staff, trying to keep him at bay, looking for an opening of his own. As 9 twirls his staff for a counterattack, focused on 8, I see a chance to make a difference. I reach out with my telekinesis and yank 9's staff out of his hands. He's not expecting it, so the force sends him off balance, right into the waiting claws of 8. 9 is slashed across the chest, his shirt torn to ribbons, the skin beneath cut open in gashes wide enough to need stitches. Both 8 and I hesitate at the sight of those wounds.
I didn't mean to get you that bad, says 8, the sympathy not really coming through his lion head rumble.
9's eyes have lit up, though.
It's nothing, he shouts. Keep going!
I've never seen anyone so excited about the sight of his own blood. Just like that, 9 is on the run. 8 gives chase, but he's lumbering in this form, and 9 is freakishly quick with his super speed legacy. 9 races up the nearest wall and flips over the charging 8. He manages to land right on 8's back, with one of his arms hooked around his neck. Being so large, it's nearly impossible for 8 to reach around and get at 9, which must have been exactly what 9 had planned. With his free hand, 9 starts punching 8, aiming for the pointy ears that poke through the tufts of his mane. 8 roars in pain, and then reverts to his normal shape. He crumples beneath 9's weight. Meanwhile, with 9 distracted, I make a run for the dummy.
Watch out, Marina!
8 shouts. I hear 9's pounding footsteps behind me and above me. I roll to the side, just as 9 dives off the ceiling.
trying that same jump kick move he used to surprise 8. Missing me, 9 rolls, putting himself between me and the dummy. 9's staff is just a few feet away. As he starts advancing towards me, I grab it with my telekinesis and send it flying at his head. The blow smacks 9 in the back of his head, making him stagger and giving me an opening to sprint past him. He shakes it off quickly, though, and is right back on my tail. Out of the corner of my eye, I see 8 has gotten unsteadily back to his feet. "Slide!" he shouts. Not thinking, just acting, I do as 8 says. I slide to the ground like a baseball player would. I see 8 start to throw a punch at thin air, but in the middle of the motion, he teleports. He reappears right in front of me. I go sliding between his legs, and his punch goes sailing over my head, right into 9's jaw. Running full speed and suddenly stopped by a right cross, 9 is flipped head over heels. I scramble to my feet and reach the dummy. I place my hands over an imaginary wound and shout, "Healed!" There's a moment where the room is totally silent, except for the 3 of us breathing heavily. 8 sits down hard, gently rubbing the side of his face. I notice that his ear is swollen closed, and his neck is puffy with fresh abrasions from where 9 was punching him. So the damage he endures in his other forms must be carried over to his regular one. 9 lies on his back, groaning. His chest is shredded from where 8 slashed him. He's got a fresh black eye, and I think I notice a trickle of blood from where I struck him with his staff. Suddenly, his groan turns to laughter. "That was awesome!" 9 hollers. Psychotic as his love of violence might seem, I find myself smiling and agreeing with 9. "That was actually a really good workout. It felt amazing to be able to push myself like that in an environment that wasn't life or death." "Man," says 9, picking himself up from the ground. "I had no way to dodge that last punch. Good move, dude." 8 turns his bruised face up towards 9. "Yeah, I owe you one. Or like, 10. I kneel down next to 8 and start healing his injuries. The icy feeling isn't so startling anymore. In fact, it's starting to feel more and more natural. "Why'd you shapeshift back?" 9 asks, picking at the gashes on his chest. "That lion dude bullshit was giving me fits. I have to really concentrate to keep the form," explains 8. "Getting my head bashed in was definitely not helping my focus." "Okay," says 9, thinking this over. "Sanders got some non-lethal weaponry stashed somewhere. You should let me shoot stuff at you, and we'll work on keeping your concentration."
"Yeah," 8 says dryly. "Sounds like a blast."
With 8's face returned to its far more appealing, not bruised state, I start to work on 9's wounds. "You know," I tell him, "you're actually really good at this."
"Fighting? Yeah, I know."
"Not just fighting. I guess, thinking about fighting."
"Strategizing," puts in 8. "She's right. I don't think I would have come up with that teleport punch if you hadn't pushed me. And awful as getting shot at sounds, I actually think that practicing might be a good idea."
9 puffs up even more than usual.
"Well, you're welcome."
"Don't let it go to your head," I say, watching the last cut on his chest slowly knit closed beneath my fingertips. I glance up at 9 to find him looking past me towards the doorway of the lecture hall.
"Hey, Ella," he says. "Did we wake you up?"
I turn to see Ella
standing in the doorway. She's dressed in street clothes. The first time I've seen her out of pajamas or one of Nine's baggy flannels in days. I'd think her getting dressed was progress, except her eyes are red-rimmed from crying. Ella doesn't look at any of us, her eyes pinned to the floor. "What's wrong, Ella?" I ask, taking a few steps towards her.
I just wanted to say goodbye,
Ella replies.
I'm leaving.
Like hell, says Nine. No more field trips today.
Ella shakes her head, her hair whipping around her face.
No, I have to. And I'm not coming back.
What's gotten into you? I ask. And that's when I notice it. Clutched tightly in Ella's hands, practically crumpled from the way she keeps wringing it, is a piece of paper. Creighton's letter.
I'm not one of you,
Ella whispers, fresh tears streaking down her cheeks.
Chapter 10. My dearest Ella, if you are reading this, then I dread the worst has already happened. Please know that I loved you as if you were my own daughter. I was never meant to be your Sapon. The role was thrust upon me the night our planet fell, and it was not something I was prepared or trained for. All the same, I would not trade away these years with you for anything on Lorien or Earth. I hope I have done enough for you. I know you are destined for great things. I hope that one day you can understand the things I've done, the lies that I've told you, and find it within your heart to forgive me. When you were small, I told you a lie. Soon, that one lie became many lies, and those lies became our life. I am sorry, Ella. I am a coward. You are 10, in that only 10 guards survived the attack on Lorien. But you are not the 10th. You were not part of the Elder's plan to preserve the Loric race, which is why you were not sent to Earth with the others. This is why you do not bear the same scars as Marina and Six. You were never under the protection of the Loric charm. The Elders did not select you. Your father did. You hail from one of Lorien's oldest and proudest families. Your great-grandfather was one of the 10 Elders that used to govern our world. This was in the time before our home planet reached its full potential, before our people unlocked the power of Lorien, and, by living in harmony with the planet, were gifted with legacies. Our young planet was at a crossroads, caught between a desire for rapid development and a need to protect what is natural and life-sustaining. It was a time of death, a time still shrouded in mystery, even to our greatest historians. During these dark ages, war raged amongst our people. Many perished in needless conflict, but eventually, the forces of peace prevailed. A new age dawned on Lorien. The golden time that you were born into, and that the Mogadorian so brutally ended. Your great-grandfather was one of the casualties of the secret wars. The conflict between the Mogadorians and the Loric that was covered up by our government to preserve the illusions of a Lorien utopia. As a young man, your father, Raylan, became obsessed with this war. You see, after the war, when the surviving elders reconvened, they limited their number to 9 rather than the original 10. Your father believed that the vacant place amongst the elders belonged to your family. Our elders had never been chosen by ancestry or heredity. Yet, your father still believed that your family's house had somehow been wronged by history. These obsessions made him into a bitter and distrustful man, and Raylan became something of a recluse. He made a home for himself deep in the mountains, more a fortress than a home. For companions, he kept a menagerie of chimera.
I was hired to tend your father's beasts. He cared for little except his secret histories and his animals. Until he met your mother.
Erina was guard.
Assigned by the elders to keep an eye on your father. Some believed that he was a danger to our people.
Erina saw something else in him.
She saw a man who could be rescued from himself. Your mother was beautiful. You remind me of her more and more every day. She had legacies of flight and elecomen, the power to manipulate currents of electricity. So she would fly above your father's home and create these brilliant displays like fireworks made from lightning.
Your father distrusted Erina and openly challenged her reasons for coming to the mountains.
Yet, night after night,
he would come to the courtyard to watch your mother fly with a chimera.
One of your father's legacies allowed him to manipulate the spectrum of light. It seems a silly thing.
Like your Eternus, but it has many uses.
He could darken the world around an enemy, making it hard for them to see. Or, in the case of his courtship of your mother, he could change the colors of her lightning strikes. Bright pinks and oranges ripped across the sky at night. Your father, for the first time in many years, was enjoying himself. They fell in love and soon were married. And then you came.
Erina had made many friends serving with the guard,
and they would come to visit, welcomed by your parents. They are gone now. The Mogadorians came. Our planet burned. During his days as a recluse, your father had amassed a sizable collection of relics that once belonged to your family. He had even spent a large sum of money restoring an old fuel-powered spaceship that he believed was used by your great-grandfather in the last Loric War. When Irina moved in, she convinced your father to donate many of these items to a museum, the ship included. When the Mogadorians came, they first destroyed our ports, cutting off any conventional means of escape. Your father immediately thought of the old ship waiting dormant in the museum. While others on our planet fought against the invasion, your father planned to escape. Somehow he knew our people were doomed. Your mother would not flee. She insisted that they go and join the fight. They argued, their most ferocious fight ever. You were the compromise. Raylan promised to stay only if you were allowed to escape. I can still remember your mother's tear-streaked face as she kissed you goodbye. Your father pressed you into my arms, and I was ordered to make a run for the museum.
Raylan's menagerie of chimera joined us, acting as our bodyguards,
many of them dying on the way. This is how I became your Saipan. I watched our planet die through the portholes of a departing spaceship. I felt like a coward. The only time I ever stopped feeling ashamed is when I look at you, Ella, and see what that cowardice saved. What is done is done. You were not part of the Elder's plan. That does not make you any less Loric, or any less a guard. Numbers do not matter. You are capable of greatness, Ella. You are a survivor. One day, I know, you will make our people proud. I love you. Forever, your faithful servant, Creighton. I stop reading aloud and lower Creighton's letter with shaky hands. There are tears in my eyes.
I can't imagine what it would feel like to have such a huge part of my identity just ripped away from me. Everyone is silent. Even Nine. Ella makes a small snuffling sound, her arms wrapped tightly around herself.
"You're still one of us," I whisper to her. "You're Lorik."
Ella starts to sob, choked words escaping her in a torrent.
I'm a fraud. I'm not like you. I'm just some rich guy's daughter who got launched off the planet because her dad was a creep.
That's not true, says Eight, putting his arm around Ella.
I wasn't chosen,
Ella cries.
I'm not. It was all just lies.
Nine takes the letter out of my hands, glancing it over.
So what?
He says dismissively. Ella looks at him, her eyes widening.
So what?
The charm is broken, Nine continues. The numbers don't mean shit. You can be 10, you can be 54. It doesn't mean anything. Who cares? Nine sounds so callous, just brushing off what is such a major blow for Ella. She looks stunned. I'm not sure that she's even hearing Nine.
What Nine is so indelicately trying to say, interjects Eight, is that it doesn't matter how you got here. Just because we flew in on different ships doesn't mean we're not the same.
Shit, grumbles Nine. I wish there'd be more selfish dudes like your pops. We could have a whole army. I shoot Nine a look, and he puts his hand up, making a zippering motion across his mouth. Even with Nine's total lack of tact, between the three of us, it seems like we've managed to calm Ella down. Her crying is slowing, and after a moment, she drops her hastily packed bag to the floor.
I just feel so lost without Creighton, she whispers to me, her voice husky. He died thinking he was a coward because he never told me the truth and he wasn't. He was good. I just wish I could tell him so.
She trails off, a fresh batch of tears wetting my neck as she cries. So that's what this is really about. It's not so much that Ella learned about herself, although I'm sure that was shocking, but what she learned about Creighton. I stroke her hair, just letting her cry. I wish every day I could have just one more conversation with my Saipan, Eight says quietly.
Me too,
Nine agrees. It never gets easier, Eight continues. We just have to keep going, to live up to what they expected us to be. Creighton was right, Ella. One day, you will make our people proud. Ella pulls me and Eight into a hug. We stay like that for a while, until Nine steps forward to awkwardly pat Ella on the back. She looks up at him.
Is that the best you can do?
Nine sighs dramatically. Fine. He wraps his arms around the three of us and squeezes, practically lifting us off the floor. Eight groans, and Ella lets out something that's part laugh and part wheeze. I'm getting crushed too, but I can't help smiling. I lock eyes with Ella, and I can tell right then that there's no place else she'd rather be.
Chapter 11. By the middle of the day, we're cruising through Missouri, just a few hours away from Arkansas. It took us longer than expected to get out of Chicago. Nine's tricked-out ride not having a super spy special feature to evaporate gridlock. At first, I'm a little nervous with Sarah behind the wheel. The way she weaves between lanes and seems to tailgate every chance she gets, until I realize that all the other drivers are doing it too. I guess that's just part of big city driving. With Chicago behind us, the highway opens up. There's nothing but grain fields on either side of us. We zip past semi-trucks as they rumble along, making good time now, not even having to use the nitrous sander installed. The last thing in the world we need is to be pulled over. I bet I'm still red-flagged in most government databases. Not that any of us even has a license for a highway patrolman to run, which is another potential problem in and of itself. When we make it back to Chicago, I need to see if Sander left any forgery material around. We need some new fake IDs.
You ever try turning a whole car invisible? Sarah asks Six,
who hasn't said much since we set out. She lounges in the back seat with Bernie Kosar in her lap.
I mean, you are touching it.
Huh,
Six replies, sitting up.
Never tried it.
Don't, I say, maybe a bit too sharply. Someone could crash right into us.
Thanks, John. If you hadn't said anything, I probably would have just turned us invisible here in public, while we're flying along at like 70 miles per hour. Good thing you're here to keep me in check, and Sarah from driving too fast.
I open my mouth for a comeback. Something about how Six is a bit of a loose cannon and I can't predict what she might do next. Like, invite my girlfriend along on a dangerous mission? But think better of it when I notice Sarah looking at me. Her eyebrow is raised, like she's confused by Six's tone. She probably has been picking up on the bad vibes between Six and me since we left Chicago. It's definitely not something I want to try explaining. So, I just shrug, brushing the whole thing off. Six is right that I've been obsessively checking our speed. Every time Sarah's foot gets heavy on the gas, I tap her gently on the leg. She slows down and looks at me apologetically like it's not her fault. The car just begs to be driven fast. Maybe I shouldn't be so anal and just let her race down the highway. Consequences be damned. That's probably what Six or Nine would do. Every moment, I'm dreading the feeling of a new scar burning itself into the flesh of my leg. What if the Mogadorians get to 5 before we do? All because I wouldn't let Sarah floor it. These are the kinds of thoughts that I've been losing sleep over the last few nights. Not specifically about 5, but on leading our group in general. There's just no way to plan for every eventuality, no matter how hard I think things over. It'd be so much easier if I had an attitude like Nine's, where I could just go out and hit things. And to top it off, there's suddenly this drama with Six, all because of one stupid kiss. Basically, there's no aspect of my life right now where I don't feel in over my head. We end up stopping at a gas station in Missouri. Six busies herself pumping the gas. Bernie Kosar ambles around the parking lot, sniffing the pavement and stretching his legs. Sarah and I head towards the store to pick up some bottles of water and pay for the gas. About halfway across the parking lot, she stops abruptly.
So, she says, maybe you should go talk with Six.
I blink at her, taken aback. I glance behind us at Six. If it was possible for someone to pump gas angrily, she'd be doing it. The way she jams the nozzle into the gas tank, it's like she's stabbing a Mogadorian. Why?
You two are obviously mad at each other about something, Sarah says. Go work it out.
I don't know what to say, so I just stand there awkwardly. I can't tell Sarah what Six and I are arguing about because, first of all, I'm not even entirely sure, and second of all, it sort of involves our relationship. I really don't want to get into all this right now, especially not when we have more important things we should be worried about. Sarah is unmoved by my silent protest, smiling slightly as she shoos me back towards Six.
Come on, you two need to be able to work together.
She's right, of course. We can't have whatever weirdness that exists between me and Six bog down this mission. Six watches me approach through narrowed eyes. She jams the fuel pump back into its home with way more force than necessary. We stand looking at each other from opposite sides of the car.
We should talk, I say. Sarah made you come over here, didn't she?
Look, I know you don't really like her.
That's just it, John, she interrupts. I do like Sarah, and she loves you.
I stare at Six, trying to sort this out. All right, I get that you're mad at me because we haven't really talked about everything since going to Chicago. With Sarah around, it just seemed weird.
John, I'm not mad at you because we kissed, and now you're back with your girlfriend. I thought I liked you, John, you know, as more than a friend. But then I got dumped in that cell with Sarah and saw the way she talked about you. And now every day I see the two of you together. Whatever was between us back when we were on the run, it's not like what you and Sarah have. Watching the two of you is almost enough to make me believe Henri's crap about Lorik only falling in love once.
I nod, agreeing with Six.
What she's saying is definitely true, but how am I supposed to respond?
Yeah, you're right, I totally like Sarah better than you. It's probably better if I just keep my mouth shut.
I guess, Six continues, I feel shitty for kissing you while you were supposed to be with Sarah.
In our defense, I say, we did think she'd sold us out to the government.
It was also our first time meeting other guard. Once that excitement was over, you were always waiting to go back to Sarah, huh?
It wasn't like that at all, Six. I wasn't thinking ahead or biding my time or whatever.
My mind drifts back to that moonlit walk Six and I took holding hands so we could be invisible. When we were together, I'm not sure I'd ever felt so comfortable with another person before. Like, I could just be myself. For a moment, Six's hard voice turns almost wistful. Yeah, me too. But it's different with Sarah, I say gently. I love her. I'm more sure of that now than ever before.
Six claps her hands as if the matter is settled.
Good. So let's forget about it. You and I are just friends, and you and Sarah are the happy couple. I'm cool with that. All this love triangle crap makes me want to barf.
Six, I start, not really sure what to say. It almost feels like she's letting me off the hook here or trying to push me away.
No, listen, Six says, cutting me off. I'm sorry I got into your business with Sarah. Whether or not you want to tell her about us kissing is your thing. I don't care. I just...
She glances over to the gas station where Sarah is finally emerging.
When I got tossed in that cell with her, the way she talked about you, she's given up so much to be with you, John. She's basically betting her life on you. Maybe I'm being nosy and it isn't my place, but I just want to make sure you're up for that.
I'm trying to be, I say to Six, and turn to watch Sarah approach.
What Six said rings true. I know Sarah has given up a normal life to be here with me, facing danger. I love her,
but I haven't figured out how to strike the right balance between keeping her safe and letting her be involved in my chaotic life.
I might never figure that out.
Right now, it's enough that she's here with me. Six calls for Bernie Kosar and they get back into the car. Sarah stops in front of me, her eyebrows raised.
Everything cool?
I have the sudden urge to wrap her in a hug. So I do. She makes a surprised little noise and I kiss her on the cheek. She squeezes me back.
Everything's cool, I say.
I take over driving when we leave the gas station. BK crawls into Sarah's lap and paws at the window until she rolls it down. The car floods with cool spring air. BK hangs his head out the window, his beagle tongue lolling out of his mouth. I guess, chimera or dog, it still feels good to have the wind hitting your face as you cruise down a highway. The fresh air feels pretty good to me, too. I don't know if everything will ever be squared away between Six and me, but I feel better after our talk. At least I know where I stand now. The mood in the car has changed. There's not as much tension hanging between the three of us. I relax a little, leaning back in my seat, watching the mile markers skip by. Sarah gently taps my leg. Too fast. I smile guiltily and slow down. Sarah has her arm out the window, her hand flat, as she lets it surf across the currents of wind. Her blonde hair is blown about her face wildly. She looks beautiful. For a moment, I pretend that it's just the two of us, and we're on a road trip to someplace fun and normal. I still believe that could happen for us one day. If I didn't, there'd be no reason to keep fighting. Sarah meets my eyes, and I swear she must read my mind. She rests her hand on my leg. I know we're on a serious mission here, Sarah says, but what if we were just taking a regular road trip, like normal people? Where would you go? I reply, thinking it over. My fantasy with Sarah and myself didn't really have a destination. It was enough just to be in a car with her. So many options. Before I can decide, Six leans forward from the back seat. I didn't really get to see much of it when we were there, because of all the running and fighting, but Spain looked pretty interesting. Sarah grins. I've always wanted to go to Europe. My parents backpacked there after college. It's how they met. So Europe is your answer, too? I ask Sarah. Yeah, she replies. There are still places I'd like to see in America, I guess. Getting locked up by the government has kinda soured me, though. That is a drawback, I agree, chuckling. Sarah turns around in her seat to look at Six. We could go to Europe together. If you're not too busy restoring your planet and all. Sarah's so enthusiastic that Six can't help but smile back. That could be fun. That's where I'd like to go, I tell Sarah, putting my hand over hers. Europe? Lorien. Oh, Sarah replies, a note of sadness in her voice surprising me. I try to explain. I'd like to show you Lorien the way I've seen it in my visions. The way Henri used to describe it to me. I catch Six rolling her eyes at me in the rearview mirror. That's not really the game, she says. Pick some place you could actually get to without building a spaceship. I think it over for a moment. I don't know. Disney World? Six and Sarah both exchange a look and then start laughing. Disney World? Exclaims Six. You're so cheesy, John. No, it's sweet, says Sarah, patting my hand. It's the most magical place on Earth. You know, I've never actually been on a roller coaster. Henri wasn't down with the whole amusement park thing. I used to see the commercials, and I always wanted to go. That's so sad, exclaims Sarah. We're definitely going to get you to Disney World, or at least on a roller coaster. They're amazing. Six snaps her fingers. What's that one ride? It's supposed to be like a rocket ship. Space Mountain, answers Sarah. Yeah, replies Six, and then hesitates as if she's worried she's about to divulge too much. I actually remember looking that up online when I was little. I insisted to Katerina that it had something to do with us. The thought of a young Six investigating Disney World is priceless. The three of us share a laugh.
Aliens, mutters Sarah jokingly. You need to get out more.
Chapter 12. Night has fallen by the time we cross the Arkansas state line. Luckily,